From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, the Chicago Bears have made some strides, progress on the field this season. They may also be making progress in the push for a new stadium. We'll discuss where that all stands coming up. And also, we'll look at a couple of the big primary races in the state, early voting just a few weeks away from getting underway. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Rick Pearson, Chief Political Reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Rick, it's always good to have you back on the show with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Rick, I've been hearing about this Bears stadium move for a while now. It seems like it gets attention and things go quiet for a while. Teams talked about moving to different locations, including Arlington Heights, where it now owns property. There's talked about moving very close to where Soldier Field is now. Just a month ago, the Bears come out and say, we're looking at Northwest Indiana. And that seemed to get a lot of people's attention. I've seen more coverage of it since then. And maybe are we seeing politicians changing their tune at all about the possibility of helping this team?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk because of the success of the team so far that this is a, you know, momentum builder. I think the team believes it's a momentum builder for getting some political action done. But I think the fundamentals still haven't changed, that most people do not want to use tax money to subsidize a professional sports team. But the bottom line is that public antipathy towards taxpayer subsidies, particularly, you know, when you look at all of the other issues going on, including affordability, people using tax money going to a stadium that 99% of them will never set foot in. Ideally, the stadium would be a multi-purpose stadium, so there'd be concerts and those kinds of things. So it would be used more than just, you know, 8 or 9 times a year. But at the same time, you know, what are the real benefits here? While the team, I think, feels it has some momentum, and I should also point out, when they brought up the issue of exploring Northwest Indiana, Kevin Warren, the team's president and CEO, he put that note out to Bears fans on the eve of them playing the Packers. And you know, everybody is going, what are you doing? The focus should be on the Packers, not on trying to play politics.
Well, Charlie, you've got to strike, I guess, when the iron's hot. The Bears have not had a lot of success in recent years, so maybe it is the right time to try to, you know, push your agenda.
Yeah, I guess, but I tend to agree with Rick that for Illinois lawmakers and Illinois officials, there are a lot of things more important than trying to give state tax dollars to a multi-billion-dollar private organization. And I think the Senate president and the House Speaker made it clear in recent comments that there's a lot of other stuff that they have to worry about before they worry about the Bears. And as a matter of fact, Indiana, there was a story that Indiana, I think it was yesterday, introduced legislation that would authorize the Northwest Indiana Stadium Authority to acquire land, finance improvements, enter into leases with the Bears. So the Indiana's governor, Mike Brown, in his State of the State address, pointed out that we're open for business and we'd be glad to have the Bears. But I don't see that happening. I think the Bears will stay in Illinois, and I think when all is said and done, they'll wind up in Arlington Heights, which makes the most sense.
Well, for those that don't know the region, Northwest Indiana is still considered the Chicago area, and there is precedent for teams moving out of the bigger metro area, maybe to a more of a fringe location, and we've seen that. And Rick, you were just in Kansas City just recently, and of course, Kansas City is moving from Missouri in their new stadium, the Chiefs, to a new stadium they're going to be building in Kansas. Not quite the same, but still, I mean, I think that's that the Bears are using that playbook, maybe?
Well, in part, and of course, I think Indiana is too. And I mean, Kansas, the state of Kansas, to acquire the Chiefs, is basically giving away the store. The Chiefs are basically having 70% of roughly $4 billion subsidized by sales tax dollars. And in fact, the sales tax district could stretch for over 380 square miles to find enough money to pay off the bonds for this. But it's the state of Kansas is all in. I've always been curious here about how all in is Indiana in this and those kinds of costs. And truly, again, I agree with Charlie that the bottom line that makes the most sense is going to Arlington Heights. I have a hard time that the NFL owners would support a founding franchise moving across state lines. And I also can't believe the NFL ownership wants on Sundays to have the blimp shot over a dome stadium with a backdrop of Gary, Indiana, rather than the city of Chicago.
Well, you mentioned that what Kansas is doing for the Chiefs. What the state of Illinois has talked about has been a lot less when it comes to, say, Arlington Heights and that location. What exactly are the Bears wanting from the state, and what are they, you think, likely to get?
Well, the Bears say they'll build their own stadium and they'll pay for the stadium, and as it should be. What they want is one, infrastructure improvements. And there's a big question mark about what they mean by infrastructure improvements, what the Bears mean. And two, they want state legislation that allows them to negotiate with local property taxing bodies, namely school districts, to achieve, quote, tax certainty. Now, as far as the infrastructure, and this has been something that I think hasn't really been conveyed clearly by the governor and also by the media, is that the state would always do infrastructure for a project like this. They did it for the United Center, which was privately built. They did streets, roads, sewer improvements, and there's no doubt that the state would be more than willing to do improvements on Northwest Highway for ingress and egress, probably even potentially using some of that new revenue for mass transit and developing some more trackage outside Arlington Park, where they already have an existing metro stop, and be able to beef up the traffic into and out of there. As far as infrastructure, though, you have this, 360-acre development that the Bears have, that they also want an entertainment district. I mean, the talk is about $1 billion in infrastructure improvements. Are they also talking about wanting the state to pay for roads, sewers, and streets in that undeveloped area that would soon become an entertainment district that the Bears own right now and would be collecting rent and other amenities from? I think there's a question mark to how far that goes. Then secondly, you have the issue of the property tax certainty. Part of that development is supposed to include residential, which would potentially include the requirement of maybe having to put a new school in that area. Those seem to be very valid question marks. And how much are the Bears willing, or how much do the Bears want these property taxing districts to abate property taxes for how long, which affects the entire, school system and local government?
Yeah, Charlie, there is political risk whenever you deal with something like this, a project. Like Rick was saying, infrastructure improvements, most people could probably get behind that. So really, the devil's still in the details here going forward. You've said you didn't think anything would happen this spring for the Bears here in election year. Do you still think that's the case?
Yeah, and I'm hesitant because I hate to try and predict the future, but I think it's very doubtful that the General Assembly, with everything else that they have on their plate, the uncertainty of our budget situation, the wanting to try and hold down property taxes to provide other infrastructure improvements. There's a whole lot of things that, as Speaker Welch and Senate President Harmon have said, are a lot more important. And the Bears themselves are sort of complaining that they've been told by the state leadership that their project is not going to be a priority in 2026. So, yeah, I don't think anything is going to happen. And part of the difficulty, I think, as Rick mentioned, the basic infrastructure, improving, say, the metro station, improving the highways, that's going to happen. And Governor Pritzker and legislative leaders have already agreed to that. The question is, where do you go from there? And how do you guarantee that the school districts are not going to get really put in a bad situation? For example, if they're forced to cut a deal with the Bears where they say, well, we will freeze your assessed value at what it is now, or we will give you certainty that your property taxes won't increase from what they are now. And then you wind up with a development, as Rick said, with housing that provides more students for schools. I mean, if I'm a local school district, I'm going to resist that kind of thing because I don't want that uncertainty going forward. It's not fair to the other people in the community. So those are the big headaches as I see it. And as I said, I don't see them getting resolved anytime in the near future. Nope. And of course, the question mark that's hanging over is who's going to pay off what's left on the bonds that were, or the money that was borrowed to rehab Soldier Field. I think, Rick, was it like $530 million is still owed?
And Charlie, you just hit the number one issue that makes everything else a non-starter, is that the Bears insist that that is a state debt, not theirs. So with that positioning, that almost virtually makes everything else a non-starter.
Yeah.
Well, when the Bears last renovated Soldier Field, this is going back a couple of decades or more now, when that happened, and you mentioned those bonds, for example, this was done in the veto session of the legislature, from what I recall. And would that be a more likely scenario? Get past the election, come back in the fall, and maybe work something out? Rick, is that a likely scenario?
It's possible, but I think there still has to be some more movement and, I guess, sincerity from the Bears here. There has to be, this is not a one-way street. And, you know, if they're part of the community, what are they going to do for the community? And I think that's also an issue too. And that's also why you still have a great reluctance among Chicago legislators for them even looking at Arlington Heights. Is, you know, I believe their price tag is a lot stiffer, but as a $9 billion entity, so be it. But their price tag, I think, is much stiffer, as well as offering incentives to help various, perhaps charitable or educational things in the city of Chicago.
Well, let's move on to another topic this week. The U.S. Supreme Court made a decision that benefited the Southern Illinois Republican Congressman Mike Bost. He had filed a lawsuit over the state's mail-in balloting system, but according to some lower court rulings, he did not have standing. Well, the Supreme Court says, yes, he does. So now that case can move forward on its merits. It's going back to the district court level. A big win there for Mike Bost, also getting him quite a bit of publicity, Rick.
Yeah, although it's interesting because there's a larger issue here, and that's the issue of states that allow the counting of mail-in ballots that were postmarked or certified by Election Day and counting them after Election Day. And that's what Bost was ultimately seeking to challenge here. And as you said, Sean, that the case was thrown out because they said he lacked standing. Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that, and this was kind of a significant ruling by the Supreme Court as far as issues of standing and whether you can bring a lawsuit, and basically ruled that a candidate's interest in the election process and election laws is actually outweighs voter concerns and interests. so that candidates for office are virtually automatically granted standing in federal court to bring a lawsuit challenging election laws. Hmm. And to see that this particularized interest was placed with candidates over voters, that was one of the issues that was cited in the two dissents to the decision.
Charlie, your thoughts on this case?
Well, I think it's, in my mind, it's kind of a significant victory, but the real issue is going to be whether or not states are going to be allowed to accept ballots that are postmarked before Election Day and count them after Election Day. Now, President Trump has argued that mail-in voting is open to fraud, and he says that all ballots should be cast and counted on Election Day. And I'm thinking he maybe misspoke, because I can't believe that he is so, what would you say, so out of it that he doesn't realize that to count all the ballots on Election Day, when the polls close at 7 and in, say, Cook County, how many hundreds of thousands, millions of ballots are going to be cast, and the election workers are going to be able to count all those between 7 o'clock at night and midnight? That's not realistically. But there's another case that's pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. It arose out of Mississippi, and what it would do is basically ban early voting. I'm sorry, mail-in voting.
As well as early voting.
Depending on how that ruling comes, it may make Bost's victory sort of irrelevant, in the sense that if the Supreme Court agrees, yes, you can't do early voting, Mike Bost will have gotten what he wants. Now, in my case, I do vote by mail. I don't vote in my precinct. But like the county clerk sent me a notice this week saying, we are going to be mailing out the ballots for the primary. We're going to mail them out first week of February. And if you didn't request one, let us know. And so they'll send me one, and I'll mark it. And then what I'll do before Election Day, I'll take it to the drop box that's right on the side of the county building downtown in Springfield, drop it in the county clerk's drop box, and that'll take care of it. And the notion that you should make it more difficult to vote, particularly for seniors, or in the case of military who are deployed overseas, for them to be able to vote, for them to be able to get the ballots in a reasonable time and then get them back, that's a big question. And the United States Postal Service has thrown another, what I would consider another monkey wrench into the works, where they've said that there's no guarantee that even if you do put your ballot in the mailbox before Election Day, it's not necessarily going to be postmarked. As a matter of fact, a number of Illinois county clerks met in, I think it was in Peoria earlier this week, to warn voters that they need to, if they're going to vote by mail, they need to put it in the mail at least a week before the Election Day.
Kind of an update on a couple of key races that we have in the state of Illinois as we head toward the primaries. One of those is on the Democratic side for the U.S. Senate. We have the Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Congressman Robin Kelly, and several others who are running there. Those are the three most well-known candidates. How is this race shaping up, Rick?
Well, starting on Friday, PAC that is backing Juliana Stratton is starting to make its presence known on TV advertisements. Krishnamoorthy is a voracious fundraiser. He's been on TV with ads. He's had the airwaves to himself since July, and that, I think, has given him, you know, an early lead in this. The question has always been, with Governor Pritzker supporting his lieutenant governor, how much is he going to weigh in? And the PAC provides a way to do that. We haven't really seen the fundraising details yet, but the PAC backing her says that it's launching a seven-figure multi-platform advertising buy. So Raja doesn't have the airwaves to himself. And Robin Kelly, who actually has outraised Juliana Stratton, but has been kind of just her campaign just seems to be plodding along. She did gain some attention, which, we can call it a stunt in introducing legislation to have Secretary Kristi Noem impeached over the activities of immigration, aggressive immigration tactics by ICE. So she's getting some attention for that.
She announced that, and probably within 10 minutes, Roger says, "Oh yes, and I'm going to be co-sponsor."
Right. And Stratton issued a statement saying, "I support it." So everybody chiming in. I still think at this stage, and again, there's large numbers of undecideds here, but it's still, I would say, Raja with his resources, demonstrated fundraising capability is still kind of in the lead position.
On the Republican side, we have a race to be the nominee for governor. And the last person who did that, former State Senator Darren Bailey, he ran against Pritzker unsuccessfully in the last campaign. A lot of people think he's the front runner on that.
Well, I think that's a largely name recognition. Bailey does not have the financial resources that he did last time around. Ted Dabrowski, who is backed by a number of people who backed Bailey the first time around, he is still kind of treading water here, not really making much of a splash. You've got DuPage County Sheriff James Mendrick, who really has no cash. And then Rick Heidner, who is a controversial real estate and gambling mogul, just now showing up in some media. And I thought one of the things that's striking is in his introductory ad, the thing that sticks out is that calls himself the Trump Republican candidate for governor. Take that for what it's worth.
I want to save a couple of minutes here to talk about somebody who has passed away that both of you are very familiar with, a colleague of yours, and went on to do a lot of great things here in the state of Illinois, and that's Dan Egler. And Rick, I'll go to you first on this because you wrote about him. You wrote an obituary about him.
Well, Dan, in many respects, was my first boss in Springfield at the Tribune. I had the second chair when I came down there in 88. Rather than a boss, he was just a great mentor and friend. I learned way so much about Springfield, about politics, about how to be a reporter, all kinds of things. I became bureau chief after he left and went to work for Governor Jim Edgar's administration. As a press aide and a speech writer, and he went on to work for, among others, Bill Brady, the former senator who was a Republican nominee for governor. And through it all, Dan would remain the same. He would always send me texts or anything else, and not of not complaining or anything else. He knew the nature of the business, and that was kind of the best part about it is you knew you were dealing with a guy who knew he couldn't snow you, or if he tried to, you'd call him out for it. He was just a terrific guy, and I was just a very big gut punch when he passed away.
And Charlie, he was, I guess, most of the time a competitor for you with you working for the Sun-Times, but you were friends with him as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and we were competitors, but I used to reckon it back in the day. It was sort of like Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan. On the court, they were fierce competitors, but off the court, they were friends. And we did a lot of stuff together through the ILCA, Illinois Legislative Correspondents Association, to try and advance the well-being of the State House Press Corps. And one of the things that we did most significantly, the ILCA used to put on a gridiron dinner, which is kind of a roast of state governments, political leaders, top figures each spring. And we would have Saturday Night Live type skits and songs, and they would be written and performed by press corps members. I was the president of the ILCA for many of those years. And so I was the host of the event, and I would be up there on stage. And Dan was rarely ever on stage, but he did all the business side of it. He secured the venue. He arranged for the dinner. He arranged for selling the tickets. He did all the, what would you say, kind of the necessary but unglamorous stuff. And he was the guy who would be sitting out there at the table with the governor or whoever else when we'd be up there poking fun at him. And he was the one who had to put up with it when some of these dignitaries got ticked about how they were being skewered. But he was really a very, very decent guy. And I was very sad to hear of his passing.
Well, let's go now to our notes from the field. Rick, we'll start with you.
I want to bring your attention to a ruling in the federal court in California, which dismissed a lawsuit by the Department of Justice seeking personal, unredacted information of the state's voters. And this is something that Department of Justice has been trying to do in other states, including Illinois. Now, while this ruling, I believe, only affects California, the fact is that it provides a guidance for the state of Illinois and other states to challenge this. And one of the passages in the decision was, Congress's purpose in passing the civil rights laws that the Department of Justice now invokes for its extraordinary request was to protect hard-won civil rights victories, allowing access to the ballot box. It is not for the executive or even this court to authorize the use of civil rights legislation as a tool to forsake the privacy rights of millions of Americans. Pretty strong statement from the federal court.
And Charlie?
Well, there was kind of a bombshell announcement this week that involves some former DePaul University men's basketball players who are among more than two dozen people charged in connection with a wide-ranging point-shaving scandal in which players allegedly sought to fix games as recently as last season. It named 26 people as defendants, accused of charges including bribery, wire fraud, and conspiracy. And this involved basically, as I understand it, you can bet on which team is going to be ahead at halftime. And so this point shaving involved players from DePaul and other universities kind of laying it off in the first half so that their team would not do as well. And the bettors who knew that this was going to happen could bet on the side and collect a lot of money. The payments to the players range from $10,000 to $30,000 per game. And it raises the issue, should betting be allowed on college basketball? The payments to the players range from $10,000 to $30,000 per game. You know, that's a sad situation. And it reminded me, and here I'm going to be dating myself considerably, of probably the worst scandal ever. This occurred in 1951, where there were allegations of point shaving and match fixing in college basketball that ultimately wound up with 35 players from seven colleges admitted to taking bribes between 47 and 50 to fix 86 games in 17 states. So this is not a new issue, but it's a sad one, and it's something that needs to be looked at.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.